From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. On this edition, our focus is North Carolina House District 18, which covers the northern tip of Brunswick County and the northwestern corner of New Hanover. Democratic Representative Deb Butler won appointment to the seat after Susie Hamilton left the House to serve in Governor Roy Cooper's cabinet as Secretary of Natural and Cultural Resources. That was in February of 2017. This is Deb Butler's first election as an incumbent. She faced no primary contest, but she does have a Republican challenger this year, Louis Harmati, who declared his candidacy no longer active. However, he will be on the ballot. Joseph Sharp, Libertarian challenger, has not responded to multiple requests for interviews. Deb Butler grew up in North Carolina. After practicing law in New York City, she returned to the Port City in 1994. Some of the boards and commissions on which she's served include the Board of Directors of the New Hanover Commission for Women, Historic Wilmington Foundation, the Cape Fear Green Building Alliance, the Wilmington Regional Association of Realtors, and Equality NC. Deb Butler, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel.
Today's interviews, as a reminder, are pre-recorded. Deb Butler, why do you think you are facing an inactive Republican candidate this year?
You know, interestingly, Rachel, the Democrats have fielded an incredible group of candidates this year. And we announced a 120 district strategy, which meant we were going to put a qualified candidate in every race, regardless of the uphill challenge it might be. And when we declared that, I think the Republicans felt like they needed to match that in some way, and put some fillers in some places that maybe didn't have a real desire to serve.
Have you encountered your Libertarian challenger at any events around the region?
No, I haven't seen either of the gentlemen, and so that's too bad. If you're going to be on the ballot, I think you ought to at least meet the voters and show up.
So you are an active candidate. What's the risk for you having those two inactive candidates or relatively inactive?
Well, the misconception is that I don't have a race. And the truth is that those names will be on the ballot. So I don't want to discourage anyone from voting for sure. Come on out and vote for me, I hope.
Reporters frequently hear from legislators that it's one thing to set a legislative agenda before going to Raleigh. It's quite another to arrive, embark on what is usually a steep learning curve, and see how things really work and what it takes to get something done. What has changed in your perception about this job since you were first appointed versus today?
I think it would have been nice for me to have the luxury of a true freshman term where you learn and observe and absorb what's going on around you, but I didn't get that luxury because immediately out of the gate, we had the repeal of HB2. That whole conversation centered in large part on the openly gay members of the legislature, and I'm one of a scant few. So I was immediately thrust into almost the national spotlight on that issue, and so I didn't have a lot of opportunity to sit back. And then as soon as that was completed, we had, of course, our Gen X challenge. And so I have been at the forefront of a lot of public discourse on these two issues in particular and others. And I'm just privileged and honored to be able to do it. But again, I didn't get the luxury of a true freshman term.
And do you think that there is a balance between going to Raleigh and fighting for your positions, for what you believe in, versus finding ways to build relationships and actually make things happen?
You know, I think that we all in this country and in this state are yearning for consensus building, relationship building, the good old-fashioned style of politics where everyone's equally dissatisfied at the resolution. I wish I could report that that were the case in Raleigh. It's something that I personally aspire to, that I long for, but partisan gerrymandering has made it such that we are more polarized nationally and at the state level than ever before, I think, in our nation's history. It is a very sad time. I'm going to do whatever I can personally to improve upon that. It's a personal goal that I have. But right now it's pretty tough.
What are some of the things that you can do to improve on that?
Well, I think that once we agree that partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering are wrong, and we put the district drawing in the hands of an independent, nonpartisan commission where it belongs, we'll begin to heal this divide. Because you understand that when the outcomes of these races are preordained, the candidates don't have to speak to anyone except their more extreme members of their party. That's a very bad situation that we have set up. And it's been by design, Rachel, you know, regrettably, so that... Again, power is concentrated in the hands of a very few extremist folks.
You're a member of several committees, including aging, finance, judiciary, for state and local government, state personnel. What's your role in some of these committees? As long as there's a Republican majority, can a Democrat find her way into leadership on a committee?
It's very difficult, to be candid, because all of the chairmanships are controlled by the majority party. I think that you have to come at it with intelligence and a level head. I try to do that, and I try to come up with good amendments to bills. You can't make big progress in the minority party sometimes, particularly as it's presently configured, but if you're smart and if you are willing to do the hard work, you can make small inroads, and that's been rewarding.
What's disappointed you about the way Raleigh works? What when you arrived and you learned, oh, there's this element to it, what was the surprise?
Well, it's extremely dysfunctional, truthfully.
In what way?
Here's a great example of that very thing. Now, as I said, when I got there, we were talking about repealing HB2, which everyone knows as the bathroom bill. It's a most regressive, embarrassing blemish on our national reputation that anyone has ever seen. We became sort of a national laughingstock over it. Governor Cooper has done his best to repeal that bill and to put forward some initiatives, and we finally did get a kind of a half-baked repeal. And I was an outspoken opponent of that because I felt like statewide non-discrimination ordinances to protect all of our citizens was the better alternative. There was no political appetite for that, but I was outspoken on that subject. And just as soon as I was, I found my office relocated. I had a corner one with a couple of windows, which is where Susie Hamilton was. I am now in what I call the Harry Potter stairwell that is windowless. And I can proudly touch either side. It is very petite.
And so are you saying that that relocation was a direct result of your being vocal on HB2?
Absolutely, and unabashedly so. They said, Representative, the rules chair would like for you to relocate to this office over here. But however, I will say this. I found out that my neighbor was Greg Meyer, who is a very outspoken progressive from Chapel Hill, Orange County. So we're fine neighbors, and we both wear it as badge of honor now. So,
you're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with State Representative Deb Butler, a Democrat from New Hanover County, the representative for House District 18. Today's interview is pre-recorded. You co-sponsored legislation with Representative Frank Eiler of Brunswick County to allow that county to charge an additional tax on prepared food and drink. The funds would have been used for beach nourishment and other kinds of infrastructure. What happened there?
Representative Eiler was very good to include me on that. That was a request that came directly from those municipalities. They felt like they needed that tool, not necessarily to use it, but to have it available to them should they desire to use it for that purpose. And so Frank and I agreed that, you know, when a municipality asks for an additional tool like that, that it's reasonable to advocate for it. So it did pass, and they do have that ability now.
You were the primary sponsor of a bill that would make a voter registration form not need to indicate race or ethnicity for it to be valid. And this bill, of course, went to die in the Rules Committee. But explain why you thought this was an important move.
I think if we look to Georgia right now, we can see how voter registrations can be manipulated for political gain. That's a threat to democracy. We can't Well, I would say we can't obviously allow that to happen. But if race is a factor about voting, then I think the Supreme Court will have something to say about it. So removing that out of it, taking it out of the equation, is the best move.
You also sponsored a bill that would require non-discrimination on the part of private schools that receive scholarship grants. The bill would also require charter schools, which are technically public schools, to clearly report test scores on their websites. This bill went to the Rules Committee after passing its first reading in the House again, where bills often go to die. Why was that important to you?
Are you seeing a pattern here, Rachel? Again, you know, this GOP supermajority rules with an iron fist. And it's not just Deb Butler's bills that are going to the Rules Committee. It's every Democrat's bills that are going to the Rules Committee to die, as you describe. It's a very regrettable situation, and that is why these midterm elections are so very important. We have to restore balance to this legislative body, because otherwise we have absolute power corrupting absolutely, and they are running roughshod over good ideas, and it's damaging to North Carolina. We see that on so many fronts.
You wanted to require non-discrimination on the part of private schools. Part of the appeal of private schools to some folks in the state is that they're able to be run according to that particular sector that wants to attend that school. And this would have been more government regulation.
I tell you what, Rachel, discrimination in any form is wrong every time.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. North Carolina Representative Deb Butler is with us today. We're spending the full hour with her since her Republican challenger has declared his candidacy inaccurate. Her Libertarian challenger has not responded to multiple requests for interviews. Coming up after this break, her views on emerging contaminants and other environmental issues in the state. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. North Carolina's House District 18 includes parts of Brunswick and New Hanover counties. Susie Hamilton was elected to represent the district for four terms. She accepted a cabinet post from Governor Roy Cooper last year, and Deb Butler was chosen to finish out her term. Representative Butler faced no primary contest. She has an inactive Republican challenger this November, not inaccurate, as I misspoke just a few moments ago. And the Libertarian challenger has not responded to multiple requests for interviews. So we're spending the hour with her exploring the issues that she's dealt with so far and what she expects to encounter in the next term. Today's interview is pre-recorded. Deb Butler, you tried to create a poverty task force. And taking a look at just poverty statistics in North Carolina as compared to the United States. First of all, the poverty rate is higher, according to the University of North Carolina School of Law. North Carolina last year had a poverty rate of 14.7%. The U.S. rate is 13.4%. In Brunswick County, though, the poverty rate is higher, 16.3%. In New Hanover County, the numbers are even starker. The poverty rate there is 17.7, and the number of people in poverty in New Hanover County is almost double that of Brunswick. What does that say about this region, and is there anything that state legislators can do?
You know, Governor Cooper talks an awful lot about an economy that works for everyone, and that clearly is not what we have just yet. You know, there are jobs available. Our unemployment rate is very low. But people are working two and three jobs because wages are so depressed. Teachers are working second and third jobs. I mean, this is a monumental problem. At no time in our history, and this may be an overstatement, but I think I'm accurate to say, have we had such inequality, income disparity. You know, the haves have, and the have-nots really have very little.
How is that a state government issue?
Well, I think we can do several things. We can increase the minimum wage, for one thing. I would like to approach the $15 level. We've done that for state employees. In fact, we did that, I think, in the last legislative session, maybe the one before. But we've done that for state employees, and we need to phase that in for all. I don't think we should do it immediately. I think we can stair-step it in an aggressive way so that people earn a living wage. You know, you cannot – a person that works 40 hours a week should have the dignity of providing for their family in a reasonable way. And that's just not the case here.
And, of course, the opposition to that is people say in a capitalistic system, you don't want to require businesses to pay people a certain amount. The market should take care of that.
The market's not taking care of it, and that's the problem. You know, shareholder dividends are up and wages are stagnant. We've seen it. The statistics bear that out. And people living in poverty, look, it's bad for our citizenry as a whole. When you live in poverty, it just creates a plethora of other problems that we have to take care of. Poor health, poor nutrition, poor learning. So raising the wages for people to provide better for their families has a long-term productive effect.
And does it have a depressive effect on small businesses?
You know, absolutely not. I really don't see that. When you raise wages and you lift people up, you get longevity and loyalty from employees, you get better performance. I think the statistics bear out that raising wages to livable wages is a win-win.
You were a primary sponsor on a bill entitled Legislative Response to Emerging Contaminants, Gen X being the trigger, of course. There's now an understanding that Gen X is a tiny percentage of the actual contamination load that's in the Cape Fear River. And the effort to deal with that news was so partisan. It was so politicized. Republicans argued they didn't want to fund an agency that they argued, perhaps understandably, had failed for three decades to prevent the problem. They wanted to go another route. So how did this become so politicized? And why, I'm assuming you're going to argue the Republican response was misguided. Why? Tell us why.
You know, we have a very industrial heritage here on the Cape Fear River. So the legacy compounds that exist in that river, I shudder to think what they are. And we'll never know because we didn't buy the mass spectrometer that was requested, the one that would tell us what's in the river. We bought the Ford Pinto version, which will only tell you what you ask it to tell you. So, again, it's keeping the blinders on because that's productive, I guess, in the GOP mindset. We have to combat this on all levels. This is should be an all-out assault. We should be funding the Department of Environmental Quality robustly. We should be buying the equipment necessary.
Well, let's just stop with that state agency because that was a huge part of the governor's push to fund this agency more and create all these jobs. But that's the agency that, number one, says they can't regulate these compounds because there's no standard set by the EPA. And it's the same agency that was supposedly overseeing Chemours emissions for about three decades.
Yeah. A couple of things. The first thing about that is that our legislature has passed a law called the Hardison Amendment, which says that we are not permitted to pass regulations more stringent than the federal EPA. So for the first time in history, the North Carolina GOP agrees with the federal government. So, we need to be in charge of our own destiny on this. We need to decide how to protect our natural resources, not the federal EPA. So the first thing we need to do, and I've asked and put forward the bill, is to repeal the Hardison Amendment. That's number one. Number two, the Department of Environmental Quality is the only agency that has the legal authority to stop these polluters from putting these materials into our river. Now, I think it's great to involve the scientific community. I think it's great to involve our universities. Let's involve everybody, for Pete's sake. We've got more than enough challenges for all. But we don't need to hamstring the one agency that has the legal authority and the teeth to stop these polluters. And so, again, I think that the majority, the leadership, didn't want to fund the Department of Environmental Quality because it was a request from Governor Cooper, and there's no love lost there. There's no mystery about that. They have been at loggerheads long before I got there, and remain so, because you remember now, he was the Attorney General and mounted many a successful lawsuit against the leadership.
But of course, the Hardison Amendment addresses so many other issues, and the Republican majority has worked for years now to peel away regulations in the form of regulatory reform bills. Did you really think, with that included in your bill, repealing the Hardison Amendment, that it would get any traction? Or are there sometimes just bills that you want to have on the record as having filed?
Yeah, I did not really believe it would get any traction. Of course not. But I want the public to understand what sort of limitations we're laboring under. And so when you file a bill like that, at least it gives you a platform to speak on this issue and to say, look at how regressive this legislation is. And so I again, had no real belief that it would go very far, but I wanted the opportunity to point it out.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Deb Butler, Democratic Representative of North Carolina House District 18, which includes portions of Brunswick and New Hanover counties. Today's interview is pre-recorded. Since Hurricane Florence dumped waste from hog lagoons and coal ash into the North Carolina waterways, there are new questions, generally among Democrats, around the way hog waste is managed in the state. But as you know, hog production is a critical component of North Carolina's agricultural economy. What, if anything, do you think needs to change about the way hog farms are managed?
Oh my gosh, Rachel, we could do another hour on this subject alone. Listen, there is technology readily available that would cap these lagoons, that would harness the methane gas that comes from them. Missouri made it mandatory. The hog farmers didn't suffer. I think they made Smithfield or the conglomerate in Missouri pay for these technology upgrades. It can be done.
But of course, it costs more. And Missouri is behind North Carolina when it comes to hog production.
Well, let's put it this way. The CEO of Smithfield Corporation makes about $275 million a year. And so the estimates I've heard are about $500 million to cap every hog lagoon in North Carolina. So if he would be willing to forego his salary for a couple of years, I think we could get it taken care of.
What would you say to people who argue Hurricane Florence was catastrophic flooding, but when you look at the actual number of hog lagoons that breached, it's tiny. I mean, it was a handful, a fraction of a percentage.
Well, I would say to them, how much hog urine are you prepared to drink? A capful, a cup? I mean, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but the idea to suggest that a little bit of hog urine or feces in our water is acceptable is a preposterous notion. We have got a unique opportunity to lead on this issue and to clean our waterways in an aggressive fashion. People are just unwilling to take it. And when I say people, I mean the Republican leadership in Raleigh. Look, they allowed the Manufacturing Alliance lobbyist a seat at the table, not the Riverkeeper, Sierra Club, not the League of Conservation Voters, but the manufacturer's lobbyist. So that tells you where their allegiance lies. And it's terrible, because this absolutely should not be a partisan issue. But I'm sorry to say that it is.
One of the proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot this November, and there are six of them, would reduce the maximum allowable tax rate to 7%. Is that an amendment that you would support?
No. And I'll tell you why. Nobody wants higher taxes. Nobody wants higher taxes. But the truth is that you shouldn't be hamstringing future legislatures, because we don't know what the future looks like. You also run the risk of interfering with your AAA bond rating when you hamstring a legislature like that. Again, nobody wants to raise taxes. We don't have to. We're enjoying great economic prosperity. But it's just not good practice to do that, and I can't support it. Never mind, Rachel, the process that we went through to get these initiatives on the ballot in the first place. It was so completely non-transparent. It was, again, one body running roughshod toward the end zone. And I believe, honestly, that these amendments, which look much like your Harris Teeter shopping list, I mean, there are six of them, as you pointed out, is done for the sole purpose of trying to inflame the voter and to mislead and misdirect and confuse every living Democrat, every living governor, Republican and Democrat, and every living Chief Justice, Republican and Democrat, do not support these amendments.
They did, however, go through a pretty rigorous process before they could legally wind up on the ballot, and now they are legally there.
Well, it's not hard to go through any process when you have a supermajority. You just tell everybody how to vote, and they vote the way you tell them. That's what's been happening.
Republican lawmakers spent just over $16 billion for general fund programs in the first three quarters of the 2017-18 fiscal year. They've seen revenue of $16.6 billion. That's a $600 million surplus. With that kind of financial management, doesn't it make North Carolina a more attractive state if you cap the tax rate at 7%? The rainy day fund just keeps growing.
It does, Rachel, but we should not be growing an enormous rainy day fund when teachers are paid at the very bottom of the national scale. You know, when our per pupil spending is at the lowest rung on the ladder. These are things that we are required to do by our Constitution. We are required to provide a good quality education to our students. And you can't tell me when teachers are driving from North Carolina to Virginia to their workplace or to Myrtle Beach that we're doing it right. We're not. And our children are suffering.
So it's understandable that you could say, take some of that money that's sitting in the rainy day fund and apply it to the to public education in North Carolina. And I do want to ask you more about that.
Sure.
But when it comes to the tax rate, why would it affect the AAA bond rating if North Carolina has such a hefty source of reserves and if the fiscal management is so good?
Well, let's think about a time when prosperity was not upon us. Let's think back to about 2007 or 8 when economic prosperity was not ours to enjoy. Again, we don't know what the future holds. And right now, times are very good and prosperous. But a constitutional amendment is something that can't be changed readily. And so if that is a cap you want to put, let's do it legislatively, where if circumstances change sometime down the line, we can amend it with more ease, and we can be more nimble and facile. You emblazon it in the Constitution, and it's pretty well there.
One of the other constitutional amendments on the ballot has to do with filling judicial vacancies. And this would change it from a process in which the governor has sole appointment power. Is that an amendment that you would support?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Oh, my gosh. You know, what about the checks and balances is so upsetting to people? This is the way our society functions. We want to be able to have co-equal branches of government who can control and the ebb and flow of what one or the other is doing. North Carolina is a heavily legislative state to begin with. There is tremendous power in the legislature. Our gubernatorial setup is already a fairly weak one. To further weaken it is really going to damage the way we do business in North Carolina. You know, he's doing a wonderful job, quite frankly. They just don't like it.
What do you say, though, to people who argue governors have too few restraints on their ability to pick judges and sometimes put political cronies on the bench? What do you say to people who argue this constitutional amendment would actually put more checks and balances in place?
Well, it really doesn't. Here's the thing. We're only talking about vacancies. You know, the governor appoints people to fill vacancies when they arise, and then they have to answer to the voter for their next election. So it's not a lifetime appointment like the Supreme Court, for example. You know, these are temporary appointments, and it's the way it has functioned historically, and I believe in a just fine fashion.
There's a constitutional amendment to establish an 8-member bipartisan board of ethics and elections enforcement to administer ethics and elections law. That sounds bipartisan. Is that something you would support?
No, it's not bipartisan. Look at that. The best practices in setting up boards and commissions, the first rule is to make them an uneven number to avoid gridlock and deadlock. Well, as you can see, 8 is not an uneven number. And what happens when that deadlocks? The decision is made by whom? The legislature. So you can see a pattern emerging. We're trying, again, when I say we, I'm talking about the leadership, is trying to concentrate power in Raleigh. And from my point of view, my observation is that we have enough authority and we don't need any more.
Let's talk about gerrymandering for a moment. I mean, we've acknowledged the fact that this is something whichever political party has been in power, they've engaged in. The Democrats engaged in it. The Republicans have engaged in it. Do you think there's any appetite? What is the incentive for building a nonpartisan approach to redrawing districts?
Well, I certainly hope that people understand how critical it is. I honestly believe, Rachel, that gerrymandering is the root of the dysfunction that we're seeing in Raleigh. I hope that people can understand, if the result of an election is preordained, then the candidate only has to win a primary, which means if I'm a Democrat and I know that I am likely to win if I get to the general election, all I have to do is satisfy the very far left, and that makes me not as compatible with my Republican colleagues when I get to Raleigh.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We have State Representative Deb Butler of House District 18 with us today after this break. More on her agenda for the upcoming session. Today's interview is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Deb Butler is an attorney originally from North Carolina who now makes her home in downtown Wilmington and serves as the state representative for North Carolina's House District 18. That district includes portions of New Hanover and Brunswick County. She was appointed to this seat in 2017 after Susie Hamilton accepted the post of Secretary of Natural and Cultural Resources. This is her first election as a Democratic incumbent. She faces an inactive Republican challenger on the ballot and a Libertarian challenger who has responded not at all to multiple requests for interviews. Our interview with Deb Butler today is pre-recorded. The expansion of Medicare has been something that North Carolina has been pretty solid on since that option came out, since the Affordable Care Act was passed. North Carolina's majority has generally opposed that expansion. Studies continue to come out. A new analysis from Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families and the University of North Carolina's Rural Health Project reports that residents of small towns and rural areas have the most to gain if coverage is broadened significantly by reducing uninsured rates. What is your take on that issue?
You know, it remains a frustration for me, Rachel, because many of the folks in the legislature who oppose Medicaid expansion represent the very people you reference. Rural hospitals are the ones that are threatened with closure, and expanding Medicaid would do so much to improve that circumstance, and it would give health care coverage to an estimated 500,000 North Carolinians that don't have it now. That's a huge number of people. So I don't understand why that hasn't appealed to Republican legislators. It certainly appeals to me. It appeals to the governor, and I'm sure it appeals to folks who are living in rural North Carolina.
You know, I want to go back. Just before the break, we were talking about gerrymandering, and you were talking about how the primary process sort of forces the extremes of whichever end of the political spectrum you're looking at. Recently, watching the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, for the newest member of the Supreme Court, those hearings, I think, were emblematic in so many ways of the political climate that we're now in. There, people who thought a very good man was being smeared for political ends alone were outraged. The people who thought the outcome of those hearings really means sexual assault of women ultimately doesn't matter in this country were outraged. Where is that outrage getting us? And do you think we're losing anything in these kinds of fiery debates? Instead of standing up for principles, are we kind of losing sight of the humanity of the other side?
Yes, I do. The great thing about my legal training is that you learn to debate people with civility. You can disagree about ideas. I can think that your opinion is just as wrong as it can possibly be. And I need to criticize the opinion, not the person wielding it. We've gone too far from that. The incivility, the coarseness is damaging us. I think it is just, I think people are clamoring for us to elevate the bar. And that's what I hope to do at all times. I don't want to mire down in the muck and the mire. But I'm afraid that we have created this circumstance, and I really believe that gerrymandering has an awful lot to do with it. Because if you force people back to the middle, which is honestly where good governing happens, you have to talk to one another to be elected. If I only have to talk to the lefty Lucy in my district, then that's not productive. I need to be able to come to the middle to have intelligent debate and forge solutions as difficult as and gritty as it may be sometimes. You have to do that to forge consensus.
North Carolina, as we know, is struggling to attract and keep excellent teachers in its public schools, and that's largely attributed to issues of funding. What do you think the state's responsibility is to boost teacher pay, look at bonuses, help with school quality issues? What really needs to happen there? Is this all about teacher salary?
You know, I grew up in the era of Hunt, and I was part of that group of school children who donated their change to the battleship. So that was a prosperous era when we were leaders. We were the shining star of the South in education. That can't be said today. And it's just, it is the single, I think it's probably the single most upsetting thing to me. Well, Gen X is pretty upsetting too, but it is among the single most upsetting things that I see happening in North Carolina is the undermining of public education. Because let's face it, that is the one thing that was would level the playing field for all of our children. Interestingly, I was at D.C. Virgo just yesterday and saw incredible work being done there. You know, we've launched a pilot program there. It's a relationship between D.C. Virgo and UNCW.
It's something of a lab school now.
It is. It is a lab school, and it is something that I hope yields fruit. But the truth is, I'm afraid we could have fixed all the schools with a different approach. I want to see what works at this in this lab, but if we had more balance in our schools, you know, we have concentrated pockets of poverty in many of our schools, and that we know statistically is a recipe for disaster. If a child is receiving free and reduced lunch, along with 65% of his peers, those children don't thrive and we know that, and yet we condemn them to these situations, and I think that's unconscionable. I hope that we'll have a newly reconstituted school board that sees that and does it differently.
And the school board debate right now, of course, is over how redistricting is handled. And there is a link between the high poverty schools in New Hanover County specifically and high minority populations as well. Some people would say it's a pretty segregated school system.
There's no question about it. When you look at, you can just compare the student populations of, say, a Parsley school versus a Rachel Freeman, and see exactly, you know, there are just a handful of white children at Rachel Freeman and just a handful of black children at Parsley. And, you know, call it what you will, but it's resegregating the schools.
Some of the arguments that we hear against things like busing is we heard one candidate for the school board say, you know, I talked to a mother who is a single mom. She works a couple of jobs. You know, it's all she can do to keep food on the table and keep paying the rent. And her child goes to a school in her neighborhood. And if something happens with that child, then, you know, mom is close by. She doesn't want her child bussed all the way to the other side of the county.
I understand that. However, New Hanover County is not that big a place. And I think that even the superintendent of schools, Superintendent Markley, has made some comments about recognizing that this is a challenge. And, you know, we're going to have to fix it because we all need to sink or swim together. And I know it's a challenge. There are great minds who are running for school board right now who I'm sure can figure out a fair and equitable approach to this. And there will be some dissatisfaction, I fear, on the part of some. But they will do a good job, I'm confident, in using their best skill set to make it as fair and appropriate and good for everyone.
Well, taking this back to the state level, what do you think has changed since the era of Jim Hunt, when there was an understanding that public education would be one of the keys to economic growth in North Carolina?
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, if you see students excelling in our public school systems and partnering with community colleges and working with our great university system, that has a synergistic effect. And, you know, businesses see it. They're like, gosh, they've got a great nursing school there. We are a medical, you know, we're selling medical supplies. It'd be great to be in the neighborhood with that program. It just an educated workforce is always going to appeal.
So what's changed then? Because you won't hear any Republican legislators say we shouldn't really be paying teachers anymore. I mean, most people will generally agree that teacher pay needs to go up.
Well, they will say that they have increased it. But I'll tell you one thing. If teachers are satisfied with the treatment they're getting, there wouldn't have been 20,000 of them in Raleigh on opening day of the short session. I can tell you that. You know,
they will say teacher pay still needs to go up.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's arguing that it's where it should be.
But they're the ones that reduced it to begin with. So it's like saying, you know, take $1,000 from somebody and give them $800 back and say you're doing a favor to them. I mean, you know, we have neglected public schools in favor of charter schools, which have different standards than public school systems that don't have certifications necessary. Some don't provide nutrition. They don't provide transportation. And so affluent children get to go to them and poor children don't. And it's not fair. And let's remember that charter schools were supposed to be an experiment where you go to this incubator, you start a charter school, you find out what works, and then you implement it in the public system. We've forgotten the purpose of charter schools.
There's not really a mechanism for that.
Right. Well, I mean, we're going to see, for example, with this experiment at D.C. Virgo, if we can lift that school up with this arrangement. But I think that if we paid teachers better and we blended our students across all of our resources and did the things that we know work already, we'd be better served.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Deb Butler, Democratic representative of North Carolina's House District 18, which covers portions of Brunswick and New Hanover County. Today's interview is pre-recorded. Deb Butler, you also believe strongly in arts education. Why? What do you think that does for a child?
Have you ever met a child that learns a second language? I don't know. They just get brighter, by the minute. I think the same thing is true with music. The same thing is true with art. These are intangibles that just have a mind-expanding quality. I'm not a scientist. I can't explain why that is. But if you could have seen, go back to D.C. Virgo. I was there yesterday to read to them. And they were wrapping up a performance of a group called... God, what is it? It was Africa, Step Africa. And these young people were there doing this performance that was so engaging. And if you could have seen the animation in the students, they participated, they learned, it was instructional. They were bright as they could be. And then, of course, I was the follow-up to that, and I thought, wow, I'm going to be very dull compared to this performance. But they were enlivened and engaged, and I read them this beautiful book, and you could just see the energy associated with it. So I'm a big proponent of arts, music, and all of the mind-expanding programs that we can afford.
Which, of course, costs money.
I know. I said afford, didn't I? Yes, that's right. We can afford it. I believe we can afford it.
The United Nations released a climate change report that sounds the alarm, emphasizes the importance of cutting emissions soon in order to keep global warming within 1.5 degrees Celsius. Of course, there does seem to be a partisan take on whether climate change is caused by humans. There was a recent Elon University poll that seems to suggest that partisan view shrinks as you get closer to the coast, especially North Carolina, where people have been impacted recently by the severity of storms. What role does North Carolina have, if any, in contributing to this effort to reduce emissions?
Oh, absolutely. We've got to reduce emissions. You know, every scientist of any ilk agrees that climate change is real.
And for the record, it's not a partisan. It shouldn't be a partisan issue because there's consensus in the scientific community.
And yet, and still, our legislature has legislated sea level rise in the sense that we can only talk about sea level rise using historic data instead of making forward thinking projections. That's ludicrous.
If you take some of that land out of the equation in terms of land that's buildable or that you can sell, then what are you doing to the North Carolina economy?
Well, yeah, I tell you what, we've had 2 500-year storms in 22 months. So we need to stop calling them 500-year storms. We know the ferocity, we know the frequency, and if we don't build in a more resilient, thoughtful manner, we are asking for disastrous results. And truthfully, Governor Cooper's leadership on this has been tremendous. Our legislature, we just appropriated $399 million. None of it was for resiliency. None of it was for water testing. Don't get me wrong. I'm happy to have those dollars. Very thankful for them. They're not enough. They're not nearly enough. Governor Cooper asked for $1.5 billion. But it's the direction. It's the philosophy behind how we're using those dollars. This is our opportunity to do it better. Why not rebuild Interstate 95 and Interstate 40 in those areas where it was completely washed out in an elevated fashion? We may come back around to that, but that didn't seem to be part of the discourse. Why not make sure that these hog lagoons are relocated? Get them out of the floodplain. They don't belong there. There's so much that we can do. We just have to have the political will to do it. And unfortunately, I don't see it right now.
Just a couple minutes left. Offshore drilling. Do you believe that the United States should move forward with offshore oil and gas exploration in the Mid-Atlantic?
Absolutely not. One drop of oil on the North Carolina coast would ruin our economy, ruin it, and our way of life. You know, you can't replace this pristine shore. And once you do, I mean, have we not learned anything? These accidents happen. I read an article the other day, virtually every oil rig is leaking. It's not a question of whether or not they leak. They leak. And it's just a matter of time until a disaster. The Deepwater Horizon should have taught us a lesson. Let's not drill North Carolina. Not now, not ever, Rachel.
That's our time. That's this edition of Coastline. Representative Deb Butler, thanks for being with us and sharing your views.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. Remember, early voting is underway. Election day is November 6th. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.